The Sermon on the Mount is the longest teaching that Jesus presented. It's the most well-known of Jesus' teachings that, you know, that were presented. And we're going to take a long time going through it. And so we're a little bit of introduction, and then we'll jump into the first of what's called the Beatitudes. If you're not familiar with the Sermon on the Mount, you're familiar with a couple of things found in the Sermon on the Mount. I'll give you a handful of them, like the Lord's Prayer. Our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be your name. You're familiar with that. You're probably familiar with the golden rule. Treat others the way you want to be treated. You're probably familiar with the line, do not judge what? You don't know that line? Hey, help play with me here. Do not judge so you won't be judged, right? Okay, or lest you be judged. So there's all kinds of things in it that probably are familiar to you. And you know, when Jesus taught the Sermon on the Mount, he rocked the Jewish world. I mean, it just set them on, you know, like in a tizzy, the things that he taught. And some of what he taught probably is part of the end result of him being crucified, was because he taught these things that were so countercultural, and they're just as countercultural today as they were back then. And you know, it set not only the Jewish world on its edge, but then once the Roman Empire, the people began to become believers around the Roman Empire, it set their world aflame. And they didn't know what to do with some of these things Jesus was teaching. And around the world today, as I mentioned last week, thousands of people, maybe even millions of people today, will study somehow a portion of the Sermon on the Mount. And again, it just continues. And some of you are like, well, I've heard it all before. I hope you'll open your heart up. Because if your heart will be open, it will rock you. What Jesus says will rock you. And so often we just read through it, and you know, I did my Bible time, I read through it, you know, got it. But got it versus got it are two different things. And so I hope you'll open your heart up. You know, sometimes people see this teaching as really about that Jesus is trying to enhance the Ten Commandments. Remember the portion, if you're familiar with it, in where he says, you know, you've heard that it say, do not commit murder. But I tell you, if a man gets angry, that somehow it's like Jesus just raising the moral standard, or he's giving this ethical code. And in some ways, there is an ethical code there, and there is moral standards. But it's so much more than that, what Jesus is trying to do. You can't. Too often, the church gets caught up, and we as believers get caught up in thinking, this is a moral standard that what we're supposed to do. So he's just laying out that, okay, we can't murder people, but now we got to deal with our anger in our life. You know, as if somehow, you know, that's kind of the bottom line, that this is an ethical thing. And it's so much more than that. You know what Jesus is trying to do is Jesus is trying to describe a new family. He's trying to describe a new society, a new group of people. He's trying to describe what life's going to look like for this new movement that I'm trying to create. That's what he's trying to describe. Characters and attitudes and priorities. And that's what he's trying to get at, is those kinds of things. And I'm just going to throw out a handful of things here that might help you understand that. You know, when I'm coaching, you know, couples that are getting ready to get married, you know, they're engaged and they're going to get married. One of the things I try and do, I mean, there's all kinds of things, but one of the things I try and do is I try and get them to talk about their finances, okay? Because it's just such an important thing because two people come and oftentimes come from totally different or significantly different financial backgrounds. You know, one family spends, one family saves, one family just, you know, I mean, they just have a different way. But if they can come together and talk about it, and now all of a sudden, if they can paint a picture of what marriage might look like with their finances, they're starting out with a brand new kind of, because they're creating a new family is what they're doing. Or, sometimes I'll talk to expected parents and they, you know, like they're dreaming about, like, this kid's coming, they're all excited, it's first child. You know, they're coming, it's all, you know, this is what it's all going to be like. My nephew recently had a child, my brother told me, he said, you know, he went out and bought all these books about parenting, and he read all these books, and he had it all figured out, parenting. And then the baby came, and like he said, and my brother said to me the other day, he said, 4 or 5 months go by, he threw all the books away. Because we can paint this picture of what it's all going to be like, and some of you are wondering, why is everybody giggling? Because if you've had a kid, you think you got it all figured out till you got a kid. And then you think, once you have one kid, you think, this is no big deal. And then you have your second kid, You guys know what I'm talking about? And then you have your third kid, and maybe fourth, maybe fifth, whatever it happens to be. Sometimes I describe it to people, when you got one kid, it's 2-on-1. Basketball. You get two kids, it's 1-on-1. You get three kids, it's zone. It's just, you just have to play a zone. We had five, and two of them were twins. And so it's just total zone defense, trying to keep the house from burning down, okay, kind of thing. And I see a whole bunch of parents shaking their head like, you know exactly what I'm talking about. But you try and paint this picture. You try and, you get this picture painted of what this new thing's going to be like. And so in the same way, Jesus is trying to paint a picture of what this new family, what this new community, what this new grouping of people that's going to be called the church is going to look like. You know, one time I was having a discussion with someone, an older woman, who did not have a lot of experience in family, living in a family. Never married, never had kids, left home early because of the depression and so on. And talking to him and, just kind of disturbed by some of the things that were going on in a family. And, especially how you help one another, you support one another, you encourage one another, and at times you get on each other's nerves, right? Just to explain to her, that's what families do. That's what families look like, to paint this picture. And that's really what Jesus was trying to do. He's trying to paint a picture of what it's going to look like. If I can get a hold of your heart and change your heart, this is what the new family is going to look like. This is what the new community is going to look like. This is what this new grouping of people is going to look like. If I can only get a hold of your hearts. Everybody with me? That's what the Sermon on the Mount is really about. Because Jesus wants to change hearts. He wants to change my heart, and he wants to change your heart. And it's not like, for me, 1979, I said yes to Jesus, he changed my heart, that was it. No. It's a perpetual, lifelong thing where the heart has to be perpetually worked on and changed and transformed. The Sermon on the Mount is a picture of what this heart is going to look like. Now, when we talk about the Sermon on the Mount, some people get the idea and have gotten the idea that somehow this is for like really committed Christians. The Sermon on the Mount is not just for the average believer, but it's like for the special forces of believers. It's like the Jesus seals. If you're a Jesus seal, then that Sermon on the Mount's for you. But just the average, it's not for me. I'm just an average. The Sermon on the Mount and the description that Jesus paints in the Sermon on the Mount is for every believer. Not just special forces, not just people in the ministry, not just, people who don't have anything more to do in life. The Sermon on the Mount is a description of what Jesus wants, of ultimately what he wants every believer to look like. Over the years we've taken lots of different times, half a dozen times, maybe more than that, over the 35 years or 30 years of the school, we've taken high school kids, some junior high kids and high school kids, we've taken them to Mount St. Helens to climb the mountain. And, you're talking to kids about getting ready. You got to do, that we have these requirements. You got to be able to walk for 4 hours. You got to be able to, without stopping. You got to be able to run a mile without stopping. All these things you got to do to be ready for it. And then you paint, you give them a picture of what the mountain looks like, maybe even show them a video of what the mountain looks like. And and then they start hiking and we're, going at it. And if you've not done it before, you walk through the timber, the timber for a long ways, uphill, 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 uphill. And then eventually you come out of the trees at timberline, and then you wind through out of the rocks and wind through some streams. And then all of a sudden you come around a corner and there is this mountain right in front of you. And you go, everyone is shocked because you can imagine in your mind what it looks like. You can even see pictures of what it looks like, but until all of a sudden you come around the corner and there's this giant mountain right there. And it just takes your breath away. That's kind of what Jesus is trying to do with the disciples. He's taking them through the timber, and then he's taking them to the rocks, and then he's going to wind through a couple of turns, and then all of a sudden, here's what I want you to look like. Here's what I want the church to look like. Here's what I want people to look like. Now, every time we've done the Mount St. Helens climb, We've always had a handful of people who just, you know, they supposedly have done all the training, whatever it happens to be. And then they get right to Timberline or shortly after Timberline and they go, I can't do this. I can't do this. Or they get to the last 1,000 feet, which is very steep. They get to the last 1,000 feet and they just sit down and they go, I'm not going any further. I'll wait for you here. They just, because they're just, their heart and their body is not prepared for the climb. See, the picture here I'm trying to paint is that Jesus once has a mountain he wants us to climb, which is going to be like him. It's going to be like we're going to see the pinnacle of it all. But it takes a lot of heart work. It takes a lot of preparatory work. It takes a lot of us offering our heart for exercise to Jesus. Everybody get the picture? And if we'll do that, then Jesus begins to do this work inside of us to make us what we're supposed to be. Here's what Jesus said about being a disciple. It's found in Luke chapter 6. He says this, a disciple is not above his teacher, but everyone, when he is fully trained, will be like his teacher. Everyone, when they're fully trained, everyone, when Jesus has been able to do the work in our hearts he wants us to do, we will be like the teacher. And the goal should be that this year of your walk of faith, mine started in fall of 1979, whenever yours started, mine started then, that somehow this year I will be a little bit more or maybe significantly more like the teacher than I was in 1979 or I was in 1983 or I was in 1999. That's Jesus' goal. Is that every year we would become a little bit more like Jesus. And what we're going to talk about today really, really becomes the foundation of that happening in our lives. There's a spiritual giant of, you know, the 1800s, or maybe 1800s, yeah, A.W. Tozer. Some of you are familiar with the name. Here's what A.W. Tozer said about this subject. He said, if the Sermon on the Mount is a fair description of the sort of person a Christian ought to be, then what are we to conclude about the multitudes who have accepted Christ, but nevertheless exhibit not one moral or spiritual trait such as those described by our Lord? And if that doesn't cause you to go, ouch, I don't know what will. Because lots of Christians across America who have accepted the Lord into their life. But there's no, you know, the working, the transformation of heart that we become more like Jesus is lacking. See, too often, believers ask Jesus into their life, but then they feel like misfits. You know what I mean by a misfit? You know, like, so they're a misfit that, well, I don't really belong, like I'm not really like the Sermon on the Mount kind of Christian. But they don't really fit in the world anymore. Because they just feel uncomfortable all the time. Like, that's not me. That's not, you know, that's for the Jesus seals, not for me. And yet, I don't belong with these people anymore. And they find themselves feeling like misfits. Jesus wants to be able to do such a transformation that people don't feel like misfits in their lives. So, let me get to where we're at. Here's the Sermon on the Mount where we're going to jump into today. Now, it's not going to be up on your screen, the first part of this, but let me read this to you. So Jesus says this, blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they will be filled. Blessed are the merciful, for they will be shown mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they will see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be called children of God. Blessed are those who are persecuted because of righteousness, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you when people insult you, persecute you, and falsely say all kinds of evil against you because of me. Rejoice and be glad, because great is your reward in heaven. For in the same way they persecuted the prophets who were before you, they persecute you. It goes through this whole list. And if we were to go to Langley today, let's just say we took a group of people and we went down to Langley and we said, okay, we're doing a study for our church. And we want to talk about who, you know, what kind of people are blessed. So if we'd started the line, blessed are the, okay? So like Jesus did, blessed are the poor in spirit, which we're going to look at in just a minute. That list that we just read is not what people would tell us, unless they were Christians or unless they knew the Sermon on the Mount. That's not the list. Here's some of the list that I came up with. So we're in Langley. We're asking people, blessed are the, and some of these things might be like this. Blessed are the rich in things. Blessed are the rich in things. Or blessed are those who have great prospects for marriage, work, and to be successful. How about blessed are those who somehow they've been untouched by loss? You know, they've just had this life where they don't know what it is to lose someone. They might say, blessed are those who have good health because they don't have anything to worry about. Blessed are the powerful because they're in charge and they can make the decisions. Or how about blessed are those who compromise at every turn? They're just willing to compromise. Blessed are those who can sit in judgment and boss other people around. Blessed are those who demand and extract an eye for an eye. Blessed are the crafty and the opportunistic. Blessed are those who are bold enough to make war. Blessed are those who, doing good things, receive all kinds of accolades. And blessed are the followers of Jesus who are praised and adored. That might be a list. That might be a list. But that's not what Jesus taught, is it? I mean, it was so countercultural. So let's jump into this first one. Here's what he said. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Now, this word blessed, you know, we use it all kinds of different ways, has different kinds of meanings to different people. Sometimes people want to say, well, blessed means happy. Well, it doesn't necessarily mean happy, because people can be blessed and not happy, and happiness is really circumstantial and not, you know, something that's deeper and more underlying than that. So some translations use the word fortunate. Fortunate are the poor in spirit. Might use that. Max Lucado, the author, he actually uses the idea, their applause. Those who are poor in spirit get the applause of heaven. That's how he looks at the idea. So this is what it's always kind of fit for me, is that blessed is the idea that you get God's approval. So when I say to someone, like I might say to Greg or Gloria, I might say, may God's blessing be upon you. I'm asking, may God's approval be upon you. So if you think about that God somehow approves these ideas in the Sermon on the Mount that Jesus is going to present, is the idea that if you let your heart be transformed to have these things as part of you, then you will have God's approval. God's approval will be upon you. And who of us doesn't want God's approval? We want God to look and go, good job, good job. So that's what I want you to get. So when he says, blessed are the poor in spirit, he's saying the people who are poor in spirit get God's approval. The people who are poor in spirit get God's approval. Now let's talk about this poor in spirit for a second, because this is all going to drive right home on us. The poor in spirit receive God's approval. In the ancient Greek language of prior to Jesus, it was the idea of being poor in the spirit was, or being poor, was that someone would cower and cringe like a beggar. I mean, we all know what a beggar looks like. We've all seen them. You know, people begging on the street corner, people begging at Safeway or wherever it happens to be. We know what that looks like. And that was kind of the picture at the time. And then in the classical Greek, it went even further. It was kind of someone who you know, got kind of down on their knees begging. In Koine Greek, the idea was a poverty so deep that they have to beg in order to survive. They have to beg in order to survive. They can't survive any other way without begging. That was in the Greek of the New Testament. So if you just take that idea of a beggar, you know, that idea of someone who's got their knee, you know, down on a knee, and they got a cardboard, you know, sign that says, you know, in this case, I need spiritual help. I need spiritual help. Because that's if you put this all together, that's what he's talking about here. He's talking about people who are spiritual beggars, People who realize they have nothing to bring. Y'all with me? That's what he's talking about here. Is the idea that people that people who have God's approval are people who recognize they're spiritual beggars. That they have to have God's work in their life. They have to have the work of other people in their lives, or they cannot survive spiritually. They got to have God's work in their lives. That's what he's talking about here. That's the picture Jesus is trying to paint. That I have nothing to bring. I cannot provide for myself spiritually. And, you know, sometimes, I mean, we can just get this so backwards that somehow we can go, okay, well, no, because if I grow, then I'm gonna be, you know, better. And when I'm better, then I have something to bring to my spiritual life. When I'm gonna mature, and when I get more mature, then I'm gonna be, you know, like I'm not gonna be a spiritual beggar anymore because I've become mature. The problem is when we have that attitude, is then we start to judge other people because we start thinking we're better than everyone else. Here's what Isaiah the prophet, and I'm going to read a couple things from Isaiah, but here's what Isaiah the prophet said, and because he had a vision, which we'll look at in just a second. But here's what the prophet Isaiah said. He said, we are all infected and impure with sin. When we display our righteous deeds, they are nothing but filthy rags. I mean, here's this great prophet that all more than 50 years spent his time speaking for God to the nation of Israel. And yet he recognized, as good as I could possibly become, that righteousness is nothing but just a filthy rags. And without going graphic here, that word, the filthy rags, refers to a menstrual rag, is what it refers to, if you understand what I'm talking about. That's what it's referring to. But it's so easy to somehow get this idea that, you know, I grow spiritually and I mature spiritually. Now I've been doing this for 4 years. I've been doing this for 5 years. I've been doing this for 10 years. I've been doing this for 20 years. I've been doing this for 30 years. I've been doing this for 40 years. I've been doing this for 50 years. And look at how I've arrived. What Isaiah says is my arrival looks like that. My arrival looks like that. See, here's what Jesus is saying. God's approval is upon spiritual beggars. That's who God's approval is on. There's this old hymn, and some in the room, the older would know it. Maybe some of the younger people won't, but it's called Rock of Ages. Rock of Ages, cleft for me. Here's how a line in this goes. Nothing in my hand I bring, simply to the cross I cling. Naked come to thee for dress, helpless look to thee for grace. Foul I to the fountain fly, wash me, Savior, or I die. Just this idea that I bring nothing to the table. And even if I think I'm bringing something worth something in my spiritual righteousness to the table, I'm mistaken. I mean, here's what Isaiah said. Again, this is the prophet. He's actually the cousin of the king of Israel at the time, Uzziah. And he had this vision. And in this vision, he saw the grandness, the magnificence of God in all of his glory. He saw this. And here's what he says. This is what it says. It says, in the year that King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord sitting on a throne, high and lifted up, and his train filled the temple. And above it stood the seraphim. Each one had six wings. With two he covered his face, and with two he covered his feet, and with two he flew. And one cried to the other and said, holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. The whole earth is full of his glory. The post of the door moved at the voice of him who cried, and the house was filled with smoke. And I said, woe is me, for I am undone. He's a prophet. He's the guy that God is using to speak to the nation Israel. This is a good guy. This is a good guy being used by God. And when he saw, see, here's what I, when he saw Jesus, when he saw the throne, he said, I'm undone. See, here's the reality that I have found, and many of you in this room have found this. The closer I get to the Lord, and the more obedient I am to the Lord, the more I see how ugly my heart really is. You know, someone said to me the other day, I was a business person in the community, and they were asking me about something, and I responded to them. I was on the phone, And they said, "You're such a good guy." And I said, "If you," I mean, I just said this on the phone, it's not a believer. I said, "If you only knew, if you only knew." And I said, "Anything that I do good," and I wasn't just blowing smoke, but anything I do good, it's because of what Jesus has done in my life, not because of me being a good person. Everybody get it? I mean, that's just the truth. I mean, here's this prophet who looks and he goes, "Man, man, man, I am undone. Because what am I bringing to the table?" Jesus talked about the same kind of a thing. You know, I'm going to keep going. Jesus one day talked about the same kind of idea, and he told this parable, and it'll be up on your screen. He says, "One time there was a Pharisee and a tax collector. One day they both went to the temple to pray, and the Pharisee stood alone away from the tax collector. And when the Pharisee prayed, he said, 'Oh God, I thank you that I'm not as bad as other people. I'm not like men who steal and cheat or commit adultery. I thank you that I am better than this tax collector who is right there. I fast twice a week and give a tenth of everything I get.'" Now, we could put our own list in there. "Oh, man, I thank you that I'm not like those Democrats. Or I thank you I'm not like those Republicans. Okay, or I thank you I'm not like the independents. Or I thank you I'm not like the guys who do abortions. Or I thank you that I'm not like the people who sell pornography. Or I'm glad I'm not like..." And we could just go down the list and we can come up with all the things that we think are the worst things that are around. I'm so glad I'm better than you. Than them. Okay. Then you too. Here's what Jesus then, he says, "Then the tax collector stood alone, but when he prayed, he would not even look up to heaven." Yeah, he's a tax collector. He's a wretched guy. He's a tax collector. And he says this, "And then, but when he prayed, he would not even look up to heaven. He felt very humble before God, and he said, 'Oh God, have mercy on me. I'm a sinner.'" Which of those two describe Americans? It's not the second one. If you're like, I don't know, is this a trick question? No tricks in it, okay? We do not look like the second. Or how about the followers of Jesus? Too often, the first one describes the followers of Jesus in America. Too often. Which one could be used to describe you? Which one could it be? Now, some of you are thinking right now, like, "Wow, Matt, you are not being very encouraging today." But here's the reality. Just walk with me here for a second. Here's the reality. This idea is very encouraging. It's very encouraging because I don't have to have all my I's dotted and my T's crossed. I don't have to have every, you know, stinking moment my life is like what it should be. To have God's approval is all I have is my heart saying, "I'm a beggar." That's what I have. Now, does it mean I can treat my wife however I want? No. Does it mean I can treat my kids or my grandkids or my employees or I can treat people in the community? No. That's not what this is about. But it's the realization that my obedience does not make me more approved by God than just having a heart that says, "Here it is. All the warts and all the rips and tears and the spots that are bleeding and bruised, here's my heart. And when I will present my heart that way as a spiritual beggar," then God goes, "You got it now." Because when that's our attitude, that's when God can begin to do the things in our life he wants to do. That's when he can do the things we're supposed to. It's not like, "Oh, yeah, you know, I'm glad I'm not like Greg, and man, definitely not like Zach," you know, kind of. I mean, I start having that attitude. Jesus goes, "Can't do anything with that. Can't do anything with that." You know what Jesus actually has to do with that? Is he's got to get me to the place where I recognize I'm a spiritual beggar in order that then he can do something with me. Everybody with me? That's what he has to do. See, self-righteousness is so ugly to God. Let me say that again. Self-righteousness, looking down our nose, riding our high horse, you know, all those terms, that is so disgusting to God. What God loves is this heart that is not looking down at other people, but this heart that's just saying, man, I am a spiritual beggar. I'm a spiritual beggar. See, excuse me. Too often what we think is that we can bring something to the negotiating table with God. You know, like we're going to, okay, like what are you bringing to this negotiation? What do we have to bring to the negotiation? We have nothing. You can't negotiate your way into God's approval. But you can. You can, in humility, not looking up to heaven, and just go, man, that's who I am, a beggar. I mean, you know your heart, don't you? You might have their neighbor fooled. You might have, you know, the people that you work with fooled. But you're not fooled. You know what's going on in your heart. Anybody with me? You do. And if you're like, I don't know if I do. Well, I'll tell you what, Jesus does. You can't hide it from Jesus. But that's the thing that's encouraging about this. You don't have to hide it to Jesus, from Jesus. You don't have to hide it. You just lay your heart out there and say, this is who I am, and this is what's going on in my life. See, we want to say, what must I do? You know, what? How to pray a certain amount, clean up my speech, give this or that, or whatever it happens to be. And the reality is the only way to have God's approval is to recognize I'm a spiritual beggar. I bring nothing to the negotiation table with God. And then God's approval. And so when Jesus said, blessed are the poor in spirit, he's saying, man, you just, I love it. Here's God. He's going, I love it when my children recognize they're messed up, because when they're messed up, I can start fixing them. But when they think they got it all. I mean, it's like you go to the doctor and the doctor says, you know, if you keep eating like that, if you keep smoking like that, if you keep drinking like that, if you keep, you know, this and that and whatever else it happens to be, and then we go like, the doctor, he doesn't know what he's talking about. I'm going to go get a second opinion. Because we don't want to face reality. Anybody ever done that? Now, a bunch of women in the room are shaking their head like, yeah, my husband does that. He does that all the time. I mean, we just have to take the physician's diagnosis, which your heart needs some serious work. And then he goes, okay, now we can work with that. That's what Jesus does. He goes, oh, now we can work with that. John, when you go, man, I bring nothing to the table, we can work with that, right? Isn't that what he does? And that, see, we can take this as something discouraging, or we can go, this is so encouraging, because all I have to do is say, Jesus, help me. I can work with that. And then he begins to do this work in our lives. And is it painful? Yeah, at times it's painful. But he's so patient. And if we don't get it the first time of the around the mountain, he just goes, well, let's take another trip around the mountain. And we take another trip around the mountain. I mean, how many times in certain things in your life, how many times you've been around the block? You can't even count how many times you've been around the block. Because you just like, okay, we're going to do this again. I remember this lesson. I didn't pass it last time, but we're going to go around the block. We're going to go around the block. And he's just so patient, because there's certain things that have to go in our life. But they only go when we say, I'm a spiritual beggar. I'm a spiritual beggar. That's the view we have to have. That's what Jesus was talking about. So hopefully we walk out of here, and those in the online, when they join us, we just can find ourselves constantly having a different attitude. Because again, it's so easy to become self-righteous, isn't it? We see all the things going on in our world. We see all the things going on in our neighborhood. We see all the things going on at work. We see all the things going on in a school setting, whatever it happens to be. And it's so easy to start thinking that we're all that. If you are all anything, it's because of what Jesus has done in you. Not because you're all that. Because you're not all that. Right? Father, thank you. Thank you that we don't have to be all that. Thank you that we don't have to be all that to somehow have your approval upon us. But instead, we just have to come to you like the tax collector. We just have to come to you like Isaiah and say, I'm an undone person. And Lord, I need you to not undone me, but redo me and fix me. And Lord, you take that and you can do something with us. And Lord, it's easy for us to get self-righteous in the world we're living in. It's easy to get self-righteous in the families maybe we're living in. It's easy to get self-righteous in the workplace we're in. But Lord, somehow give us eyes to see exactly what's going on in our own heart, that we can present ourselves and say, Lord, I'm undone. Lord, I'm undone. Lord, I'm undone. Lord, I'm undone. So that you can take and continue to transform us. Lord, we do love you, and we want to love you more. In Jesus' name, you say amen.